Good afternoon, everybody, and we really want to take this opportunity to welcome you all to this session. And for the interest of time, despite the little quorum, I think we'll just go ahead as people are actually out for lunch because we had this session that actually delayed here. So this afternoon, we are going to have an interesting panel of speakers. And I need to apologize at this point in time. We're actually expecting a presentation to be done by one of the speakers from Myanmar, but since he was not able to travel to Paris, we'll just have to go ahead with what we have. Our first speaker is going to be Ian, and we kindly invite him to take the floor.
Thank you very much. I can understand that after the global emergency of XDR, the debate around rationing of treatment services is perhaps not as interesting. But I still thank the organizers for inviting me to present this paper that has in fact been published in The Lancet quite some time ago, but it's hopefully opening or beginning a debate on the rationing of antiretroviral therapy services for AIDS in Africa. And I believe while this is a TB conference that the rationing discussion is important in the context of treatment services in resource-poor settings, regardless of the type of disease. And it is the efficiency of a service rationing, efficiency defined as the medical outcome, preventing death, improving CD4 count, improving undetectable viral load, and the prevention of opportunistic infections, including TB, that needs to be balanced against the equity of access to treatment for all. And in this whole framework provided a reality of the number of patients that require treatment. The overview of the presentation. Firstly, I will discuss the issue of rationing treatment. Why do we need it? How is it currently rationed? Evaluate some of the rationing systems that are currently in operation, and then discuss the conclusion of the balance between efficiency and equity. So why do we need a rationing system? I probably speech the converted. There are 26 million people living with HIV in sub-Saharan Africa. By conservative medical standards, we consider about 4.7 million of those individuals to require antiretroviral therapy today. And if we look at the number of countries that have actually achieved the target of 50% of these 4.7 million, by March 2006, none had achieved this target. And in fact, most will not achieve this target within the next 2 years. The scarcity of funding resources, as well as human resources and infrastructure, will preclude universal treatment access in most countries in Africa. If we look at the WHO report from 2006, we see that, in fact, it's Botswana who have achieved 86% coverage of their targeted 84,000 patients with an enormous infrastructure and funding implementation. In my own country, South Africa, despite the large increase in the number of patients on antiretroviral therapy since the rollout plan was begun in 2004, we have only achieved 21% of our target. This figure comes from the WHO report, and today the figure is more like 260,000 patients on treatment. Put into perspective, that is the same number of patients on treatment in South Africa as there are in the entire United States of America. So clearly rationing systems are inevitable and are happening, and will persist for a number of years, not only because of the large number of patients that we need to put on treatment, but because the number of patients will increase with time as more and more patients move from HIV to AIDS. And in addition, as the large number of patients that we successfully treat accumulate, so too the pressure on the rationing system will increase. Rationing may be efficient, and successfully achieve its targets of reducing the number of patients on treatment, or inefficient. It may be fair or unfair, and however, whichever system is introduced as a rationing system, it must be sustainable, as treatment failure and resistance and death clearly cannot be an outcome that we wish to achieve. Governments have vast experiences in rationing systems. In healthcare, in particular, we know that dialysis, for example, is targeted to a very restricted number of patients in South Africa. We also know that road infrastructure is targeted towards the best possible economic benefits of road infrastructure. And while health and rationing is a contentious debate, it does require open public policy debate and deliberation of the choices to ensure the best not only the best medical outcome, but also the best social and economic outcomes. This is clearly not a debate that is normal for a healthcare worker or doctor to lead, but in fact is critically important as we scale up treatment. So how will treatment be rationed? Any rationing system is a policy, or any policy or practice that restricts the consumption of goods or services where the demand versus the supply is unequal and needs to be equalized. Most of the goods that are rationed in our society, in our free market economy, is based on price. But in healthcare, we do not wish to put a price on it. And so, based on a non-pricing system, we need some sort of criteria to decide who will receive their treatment first. These criteria may be explicit criteria, in which we state them up front and control the amount of treatment access, targeting it to particular populations, or they may be implicit arrangements that allow for a differential access that becomes implicit because we do not have explicit systems. Rationing is not intent on depriving anybody of treatment, merely applying the scarcity of goods to the correct populations such that the best possible outcomes may be achieved. Non-price rationing becomes inherently political, and in an ideal socialist system, everybody should have equal access. But in this instance, as we scale up treatment services, we are not able to provide absolutely equal services to everybody at the same time. Multiple types of rationing need to be balanced and in fact may prevail at the same time to bring together a complete picture of where the treatment services are applied. For our presentation, we have applied a definition of a rationing system for HIV treatment as being the use of any public resources that prioritize antiretroviral therapy on the basis of either medical, social, economic, or cultural criteria, whether these are explicit or implicit, and where the public resources include resources from governments, international donors, etc. Important is that we are, in the presentation, emphasizing the non-medical criteria, because we assume with the advent of treatment guidelines that medical criteria will be applied equally throughout the population and society. The stated explicit rationing systems are programmatic, or policies that are attached to specific populations. Or they may be conditions that favor particular types of populations. Whereas implicit are procedures that we undertake to limit access, without specifying which population we wish to limit the access to. They may become implicit if they are informal arrangements that create criteria for preferential access. So some of the programmatic or explicit type of systems that are currently in operation today include the provision of treatment for mothers of new infants, or the MTCT Plus program, supported by the Elizabeth Glaser Foundation. Skilled workers targeted by the healthcare worker, by the WHO guidelines, which explicitly state that healthcare workers should be prioritized for access to antiretroviral therapy. In Uganda, government staff have preferential access to treatment. And in many countries, including my own, specific programs for soldiers have been established. Poor vulnerable populations may be explicitly targeted by programs, such as the PEPFAR program, now targeting children with 10% of its funding, or the South African National Antiretroviral Therapy Program, which explicitly states that it targets the underserved population and rural populations. Clearly, targeting high-risk populations, such as IV drug abusers, truck drivers, or sex workers, may have the preference of addressing not only their HIV treatment needs, but also a concern around HIV transmission. The WHO criteria or guidelines, in fact, specifically address CD4 count as an explicit rationing criteria. The difference between the WHO guideline and the United States or European guideline centers around the initiation of treatment at CD4 count 200 versus 350 in US and European guidelines. That was not done for medical reasons. In fact, in medical terms, the European and United States guidelines are probably addressing the needs of the population better than the WHO guidelines. It was done purely and explicitly for rationing terms. Residents of a designated geographic area, catchment area of a clinic, is in essence an explicit rationing system. The ability to co-pay, as performed in Uganda, is an explicit rationing system. And the demonstration to the commitment to come to the clinic, adhere to clinic visits, undergo an education priority before treatment initiation, is in essence an explicit rationing system. This is opposed to implicit rationing systems. So we know from employed sector treatment programs where on-site VCT is offered to all employees of a program, that we can control the number of HIV-positive individuals identified for treatment by the amount of VCT access that is given to these employees. Similarly, the transport costs limiting patients returning to the clinic or initiating the first clinic visit may be an implicit rationing system that prefers individuals who have the resources to come to the clinic from those who do not. In most clinics across Africa, the first come, first served motto applies, where when we have limited resources and a limited number of slots available for antiretroviral therapy, those who know first about the clinic and attend first will have the preference of being treated in the long term. And queuing is a phenomenon all over the world which does preference those who are unemployed, as the opportunity cost of attending the clinic is less than those who are employed and may not be able to attend three clinic adherence visits before initiating antiretroviral therapy, meaning 4 days of work and, in essence, the danger of losing their jobs. If implicit rationing systems are applied and explicit rationing systems do not prevail, then the next phenomenon is queue jumping, which does preference those who have the ability to negotiate and bypass the queue. Or else, a black market for antiretroviral therapy develops and selling of drugs has become a phenomenon across Africa. So in evaluating the treatment systems or the rationing systems, we considered six categories to find a balance between these different systems. The first is effectiveness. How good is the rationing system at leading to a outstanding medical outcome? And therefore, it is a ratio of successfully treated patients to all the treated patients in the population. What about cost minimization? Can the rationing system be applied and save costs at the same time, or which is most cost effective. Cost saving per patient treated relative to a high cost standard was considered. Is the system, rationing system that we wish to introduce, feasible? Is the probability that the human and infrastructure resources are available to implement the program, Economic efficiencies. These are efficiencies that consider the net human capital gain or retention from the rationing system and do not consider cost or feasibility as part of economic efficiency. And then social equity. Is the probability that poor or disadvantaged populations will have equal access to treatment the same as those of advantaged populations? And then, can we actually control the number of patients attending the clinic? Other criteria that may become available or considered in the future may include impact on HIV transmission, sustainability, and the effects on the healthcare system as a whole, balancing the needs of HIV against other health priority needs. So we tabulated this to consider high, medium, and low as effectiveness of the rationing. And as an example, I won't go through each one of these, but as an example, the MTCT Plus program is considered medically neutral. It's not particularly effective in addressing the needs of the population. It's cost neutral, because we certainly can cost effectively implement it. It is very feasible, because we are identifying patients through the PMTCT programs and VCT and already have a targeted population, and therefore can introduce treatment very rapidly. Its efficiency as measured in human capital, we in our opinion and from our value system have established that it does retain human capital because of it's a head of household program and does prevent, it potentially prevents, if we can start treatment early enough, the transmission of mother to child, and also maintains or prevents HIV orphans from occurring. Equity, we rated it as low because it's a mothers and women's program and disadvantages men. And in terms of rationing, well, we probably do have a rationing. It does provide some rationing, but it doesn't. It's not high and doesn't target the populations successfully. On the other hand, if we look at the bottom line here, adherence commitment, it is an effective system because it targets those who can come to the clinic and do attend the clinic regularly before initiating antiretroviral therapy. It's extremely cost-effective because it doesn't cost much to introduce a number of lay counselors who go through the education process with patients before they initiate treatment. It is clearly feasible. And in terms of human capital, it actually is neutral because it is one of the systems that is extremely equitable. And so both disadvantaged poor populations as well as advantaged skilled workers can access the same clinic if they go through the adherence commitment step. And therefore we rate it as a poor rationing step. It doesn't reduce the number of patients who come to the clinic. And that is our experience in Johannesburg, South Africa, where we have some of the largest clinics with patients on antiretroviral therapy. Implicit systems, on the other hand, lead, if we look at the first come, first served, or the queuing system, are certainly effective. We place a barrier and say, we're only going to see 300 patients today, and tough if you come and you're patient number 301, you'll have to come tomorrow. It doesn't cost us very much. It is certainly feasible. It's done all over the world. However, its efficiency is extremely poor. And as we are not addressing the needs of the human capital retention at this level. It is, however, equity neutral, as disadvantaged populations, in fact, we classified it as neutral because we considered that skilled workers would have less of a chance to access treatment in a queuing or first-come, first-served system than unskilled workers. It is an effective rationing system that leads to a lot of queue jumping. So, some comments on the evaluation. These evaluation domains and how they are interpreted are the ratings that reflect our own values and experiences and are meant to, in fact, open a debate. Some of the ratings are well-grounded on prior experience, and the example here is the treatment of skilled workers does preserve human capital. Some of the ratings are highly speculative. Some are, can be affected by research, and we will change these ratings as we conduct our own research. So we know, for example, that co-payments, while we expect it to improve adherence because people have a buy-in to the system, we now know that it discourages adherence. And in fact, when people don't have money, they don't come to the clinic. Effects on HIV transmission will become more and more important as time goes by and may become important reasons for targeting particular populations. And then important to consider is that these domains do interact. And we know that something that is extremely costly may not be feasible. But we also know that a highly inequitable system that is not politically defensible will also not be sustainable. So in conclusion, the efficiency of a rationing system, shown here on the y-axis, may be high. But in most cases, if with a high efficiency, equity is extremely low. What we do need to avoid is the block at the bottom here, which is both inefficient and inequitable, and those are the first come, first serve plus queue jumping, or queuing plus queue jumping. And consider some targeted programs that improve efficiency, such as those for mother skilled workers and co-payment, at the expense of equity. We do know that in the National Rollout Program in South Africa, which I'm very much involved in, that the commitment to adherence provides high equity and moderate efficiency. Most important is the question of how equity will be achieved, and in fact, what the best strategies of rationing are. And I really wish to come to the last slide, and this is the emphasis of the presentation and the debate, and that is who will decide which rationing system will be applied. If it is at a government level through legislation and regulation and resource allocation, that is the ideal. It may come through international bilateral agencies and the donor agencies applying particular criteria as to which programs they will support. If these two fail, it is down to the healthcare managers and financiers who, through their facility policies and procedures, will need to address the rationing. And failing that group, it will be down to the frontline healthcare provider through the standards of triage and informal and personal arrangements that they decide to who will be receive treatment and who will not. Clearly, leaving it down to the healthcare worker, who has an ethical debate each day, is not the ideal and will not lead to the benefits of of rationing targeted to particular populations and targeting the best medical, social, and economic outcomes. I wish to acknowledge my co-authors, and this publication is available online through the Boston University website. And I think that we are not taking questions now, so I thank you for your attention, and we'll have question time later. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ian Sain from South Africa. And for those who've just joined us, we are looking at issues in access to ART in low-income countries, and we've just been able to look at the South African experience whereby We are talking about rationing ART in HIV and AIDS settings in a scenario more so whereby the demand actually exceeds the supply. And I was just wondering, since I think we still have a lot of time, we could actually take some 5 questions or 1 to 5 questions.
Sorry.
No, it's just that you are ahead of time and we don't have the speaker from Nyama, so we could take some questions and then move on to the next session.
I must say I was very surprised that I was ahead of time and really appreciate some questions.
Solly Benita, University of Cape Town. Thanks again. I enjoyed that presentation very much. 2 quick comments, if I may. The first is to draw your attention to some work done by Norman Daniels and James Sabin on what they call accountability for reasonableness. It's a mechanism for explicit priority setting or explicit rationing, if you like, that is open and explicit and transparent and accountable and involves all the stakeholders in a way that makes it acceptable. So I draw your attention to that, and I can provide you with the reference for that. The second point I want to make is that, you know, we are facing at this conference at the moment the problem of multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis and XDR-TB, and of course this is what's on the horizon for HIV. It won't be long before we have multi-drug-resistant HIV and XDR-resistant HIV. And so it would seem to me that one of the features that you have to bring into your priority setting mechanism is the ability to sustain treatment, not only adhere to it initially, because it's the defaulters and those who start and stop that are going to contribute, I would imagine, most to the development of resistance, although I'm no expert in that field. So I would suggest to you that you need to consider the possibility of emergence of resistance as a factor that needs to come into your rationing system.
Thank you very much for that question. Clearly, we do consider resistance as part of the medical outcome. We did focus in this opinion piece particularly on the non-medical criteria because we feel that the guidelines would have established some sort of basis on which the medical criteria would be dealt with in all different systems of rationing. Resistance or the definition of treatment success, medical outcome success, would include the prevention of the development of resistance because the number of patients who would be retained with an undetectable viral load and immune reconstitution defined as CD4 count increases. And so clearly, I think as an HIV treating clinician, what the treatment guidelines in South Africa and in principle in the WHO treatment guidelines have done is provided for first and second line treatment options. Once patients have developed significant resistance to the second line treatment option, the current way of handling those patients is to maintain the ongoing treatment of that second line regimen. That, however, may not be the best possible rationing system in terms of resistance. And we should consider that patients, as a balance to this, consider that patients who have failed their second-line treatment regimen are in fact taken off treatment. The difference between TB and HIV is the rapid evolution back in HIV to the dominant population being the wild-type, non-resistant population, whereas in TB, clearly the transmission of resistance is of ongoing concern. Very contentious. And Professor Benita is an ethicist from Cape Town University. In fact, was my examiner a while ago. So,
thank you very much, Ian. I have another question, and I was just wondering, when you talked about the implicit system, how do you manage the queue jumping? And then secondly, I was just considering that due to the high demand, are you faced in a scenario whereby it actually you end up compromising the quality of care in relation to the number of patients you're seeing on a daily basis?
Yeah, so I think this is exactly the debate, exactly the problem. Tembeletu Clinic is our main site in Johannesburg. We have 6,500 patients on antiretroviral therapy, and we initiate approximately 250 a month. We attempt not to have a queuing system, a waiting system, but in fact have a queuing waiting system that is currently at about 2.5 months. We have tried to address queue jumping by looking at who needs to queue jump and have introduced specific clinics for patients with low CD4 count and AIDS-defining opportunistic infection, or mothers with a CD4 count less than 200, pregnant women who are with a CD4 count less than 200. And so, in essence, have introduced explicit queue-jumping systems. And that kind of thinking is what each clinic needs to consider to efficiently address the treatment needs. In terms of quality of care, we try and maintain the maximum number of appointments per day to try and make sure the system doesn't become overwhelmed. But clearly our clinic is an example of where the accumulation of patients leads to additional pressure on the rationing system. And so while we hope our outcome measure in terms of patients' undetectable viral load still addresses the efficient and quality of the service, efficiency and quality of the service, it is in time to come that we will be able to measure whether, as the pressure increases, our quality reduces.
Thank you very much, Ian. Okay, the last question.
Thank you. This is Vineet Bhatia from India Office of the Union. I'd like to ask you two questions. The first one is, like, when you talk about rationing of ARTs for HIV/AIDS in settings where demands exceed supply, now, do you think this would lead to a kind of complacency in the system where they would like to adjust within the available resources rather than increasing the excess, putting in more resources for ARV access? And the second part is, like you briefly mentioned, how do we address the ethical issues when we say it should be an equal access of treatment to everyone?
Okay, so to the first question, clearly, well, within our system, and we have multiple forms of treatment delivery under the program that I manage under Right to Care, we are putting pressure under every one of those, on every one of those clinics or healthcare worker providers to, in fact, perform in excess of their ability, of their comfort zone. In other words, we're not making it easy and seeing, you know, letting people see 10 patients a day. The consultations, the number of consultations at Tembeletu exceed 300 per day on most days. And so, in fact, once we understand what the maximum number of patients that a clinic can see, and we're achieving those targets, we need to put more pressure on more infrastructure, more money, more human resources. But those are not equally available at the same time, distributed across the country. And so even in the ramp-up phase, some sort of rationing and targeting of populations has to occur. And to the ethical debate, that this is exactly an open ethical debate. And while we have positioned, you know, the first idea, I think that each center needs to, in fact, have this public debate, this open debate, to address their own balance in ethics and to discover which patient populations they wish to address first. But it needs to be debated. For us, the question is, if you don't debate it, then all that happens is that you get these implicit rationing systems and queue jumping. And so that's exactly the issue. Who do we address first? And an economist will support looking after skilled workers and maintaining human capacity in society, whereas a purist would say that it has to be absolutely equal and the rationing system has to ensure absolutely equal access. And a lottery would be the best way to, in fact, decide who should get the treatment service first.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ian. I'm just going to request if you could hold. I can see the two questions that are coming up. If we could just move to the next session and then we could take up your questions, if you don't mind. We'll still have the panelists.
You see how contentious this is.
I can see.
Within a family, if two members of an HIV positive, and if you are going to give only one member in a family, sharing of the drugs, it is more going to be more complicating the, even leading on to drug resistance, and possibly it is more causing damage rather than doing something good.
Okay, so one of the slides that I skipped was exactly that issue, that in fact targeting family members, and we have a study in South Africa called Safeguard the Household, funded by the NIH, which is targeting entire households rather than just family members for treatment, with the ideal that in fact treatment adherence will improve if there are multiple members within a family, both disclosed to each other, but and on treatment, and so in fact adherence will improve. Our experience in South Africa is that treatment sharing is actually is not a common phenomenon. With good education up front, patients understanding that they need to take their own tablets themselves and treatment sharing is not an option, we are not finding much treatment sharing occurring.
Thank you very much, Ian. Over to the co-chair, Rita.
Thank you very much, Lucy. I'm Rita Lodlo, HIV program coordinator for the union based in Zimbabwe. I regret to inform you that our second speaker, Irene Makwiza, was unable to join us here in Paris. However, the good news is that Grace Bongololo has agreed to come in and speak on provision of ART issues as they pertain to Malawi, and her title of her presentation is whether provision of ART can be equitable when the whole health system is inequitable. Grace Bongololo is a social science researcher based in Lilongwe, Malawi, and working for REACH Trust. Over to you, Grace.
Good evening, gentlemen. As the chair has already stated, I'm making this presentation on behalf of Irene Makwiza, who, due to some other factors beyond her control, she couldn't make it to Paris. The presentation is based on Malawi experience. That is the time when antiretroviral was provided at a fee, at a subsidized fee of 2,500, and from the time when antiretroviral therapy was provided free of charge at the point of delivery. It is believed by many that Malawi is like provides like a flag whereby the demographic indicators, they give, they are symbolize the situation in most of the sub-Saharan countries. But I also believe that experiences from Malawi can also act as an example of some of the countries in the sub-Saharan region, and I believe that experiences from Malawi can be also adopted in some other countries within the region. Just a quick outline of the presentation. I'll present to you the health system in Malawi, then Equinet, that is the Southern African regional network on equity in the provision of antiretroviral therapy, what it has done in Malawi, for example, in the sub-Saharan region, and lessons learned, lastly but not least, recommendations. The health system in Malawi is inequitable, whereby we are experiencing a severe shortage of health personnel, whereby we have 1.1 doctors per 100,000 population, 25.5 nurses per 100,000 population, that is according to WHO 2004. And most public health facilities, they lack capacity to deliver essential health package, even if where the services are available. And we have a situation whereby the ultra-poor, they spend close to 7.4% to 10% of their annual consumption on health. So from this, you can see that they are spending more on health what they have for other amenities. And access to health services is also a problem, whereby we have 84% of the population having access to health facilities within a radius of 8 kilometers. But this does not take into consideration some of the districts which are like which are mountainous. So it's like the access to health facilities is problematic to them. With limited resources available for HIV and AIDS treatment programs, there are some major issues on equity. For example, on equity of treatment programs, who have access, which programs have access? Because maybe you can say more women are having access, but what categories of women are having access? And again, the other issue that is mostly neglected is the impact of antiviral therapy on the wider health system. Is it a vicious circle whereby antiviral therapy programs are drawing resources from the entire health system, or the resources that are pulled into the antiviral programs, are they having a positive impact on the health system, whereby they are strengthening the health system further? Just a quick run-through of some of the terminologies that we're using. By equity, we mean addressing differences in health status that are judged to be unnecessary, avoidable, and unfair. Whilst by health systems, we mean all activities that promote, restore, or maintain health. This is just a picture whereby saying impact of ART on HIV programs on the health delivery system. Is it a vicious cycle, for example, whereby the services in the ART program, are they withdrawing or detracting services from the health system, or are the services in the ART program, are they contributing, that is, strengthening the health system further? That is the vicious cycle and a vicious cycle. Now, looking at the equity initiative on the equity in provision of antiviral therapy, Equinet conducted studies on issues relating to health sector responses to HIV/AIDS. Some lessons were learned from the studies, and through regional consultations, policy principles for equitable and sustainable ART rollout were elaborated, and indicators for monitoring equity were developed. We had two areas of equity, justice and accountability, whereby we're looking at how the policy, ART policy, how was it developed? Is it possible to monitor it? Was the process fair? Who were consulted, for example? Because we know that different groups in the society, they have different needs. So if maybe a certain segment of the society was consulted, leaving out the other, who could like bring the concerns of them into the development of the policy? And also looking at the targets, are they realistic? Are they achievable? And we also had five areas of sustainability and efficiency. Having this policy, will the programs be sustainable? And will the services, are they efficient? Now, just a quick outline of the ART and health system monitoring that is experienced from Malawi. Working with key stakeholders, we conducted an equity analysis of data, whereby we routinely collected data, and we did a sentinel analysis, and also a synthesis of findings from operation and qualitative research, had key informant interviews, and we also do participate in technical working groups. In Malawi, we aim to have 80,000 people on ART by 2005, and having a total of 250,000 people by the end of 2010. As I earlier on alluded to in the previous slides, antiviral therapy is provided free of charge in public sectors, including that is Christian Health Association hospitals. That these are hospitals which are funded partly by the different churches in Malawi on a first-come, first-served basis. The number of people ever started on ART increased from about 4,000 patients in June 2004 to about 57,000 patients by the end of June. This number is like when antiviral therapy was provided at a fee, and this was when antiviral therapy was provided free of charge on first-come, first-served basis. And after introducing the free ART, the 39% were men, whilst 61% were women. 94% were adults, while only 6% were children. or 17%, that is close to 9,633 of patients who were on ART were coming from TB programs. And only 1% were women who were referred from BMTCT programs. Free ART has improved access for the poor and the vulnerable. As you saw in the previous slide, after ART was provided at a fee, many people were unable to access treatment, but after it was provided free on first basis, many people came forward, and some with maybe also higher CD4 count, they also wanted to access treatment. So access was a little bit improved. However, qualitative research findings revealed the following barriers to access and adherence. Most of the time, the situation is like when services are free of charge, we expect people to be accessing treatment without our problems. But the qualitative study that was done at a site whereby antiretroviral therapy was provided free of charge, and there are also some other services to decentralize treatment. These were some of the barriers that were found to be there. Lack of food, for example. Transport costs for patient and guardian to and from the hospital. Stigma and discrimination. Long distances to the health facilities and long waiting times at the health facilities. What lessons were learned in access to ART in Malawi? Free ART at point of delivery enhances access. That is, user fees hinder access for the poor and reduce long-term adherence. That is, if somebody doesn't have a transport to go to the hospital to access treatment, there is no way that person can go to access treatment. That is, he or she is going to default up until he or she accesses transport to go and access treatment. We also have more women accessing treatment than men. That is, we also need to consider access versus preference by gender. That is, is the access by need? It can happen that we have many women who are in need of treatment than those who are accessing treatment. And it can happen that the men who are also on treatment, a lot more are not accessing treatment. So this is a point that has to be considered when we're analyzing access to antiretroviral therapy. Services are biased towards urban areas, whereby most of the ART services, that is starting with counseling and testing, as well as antiretroviral therapy clinics, or most of them are concentrated in the urban areas. But 15% of the population in Malawi lives in the urban areas, whilst a total of 85% lives in the rural areas. Though prevalence data shows that prevalence of HIV/AIDS is high in the urban areas than in the rural areas, but from the population that lives in the urban and in the rural areas, you can see that if you have 5% from the 85% and 5% from the 15% that is living in the urban areas, you find that the figures are going to be high in the rural areas, despite that the services are concentrated in the urban region. And as you saw from the previous slide, child uptake of treatment is low. A lot more has to be done on the pediatric patient who are in need of antiretroviral therapy. And free treatment at first-come, first-serve basis may serve the urban, higher educated, and non-poor people. And involvement of our private sector. We have 38 private facilities who are providing antiretroviral therapy at a highly subsidized fee. And these private facilities, they help to lessen the burden on the private facilities who are providing antiretroviral therapy. And on human resources for ART, human resources is a key challenge for scaling up. I think this song has been sung for many countries, and I think the situation in Malawi is not different from other countries within the region. And HIV/AIDS impacts on staff workload, morale, occupational exposure to HIV/AIDS. In a situation whereby health workers are afraid of contracting the virus by treating the patients, this is a barrier whereby they are more likely to neglect some patients who are HIV positive. The Malawi Human Resource Emergency Relief Plan costed at close to 273 million US dollars with funding from Global Fund, GFID, and Schwab, intends to expand training capacity by 50% on average, improve retention and re-engagement. That is, those health workers who retired, they are being called back to join the health system, and increasing top-up salaries by 52% for 11 critical cadres, that is clinicians, nurses, and other technical positions. There's also a stopgap external support for critical posts, for example, for volunteer doctors and nurse tutors. However, salary top-ups for some cadres and members of staff and not others in the same health system raises a lot of equity questions. Are they not health workers? What can be done for them? And we also have a critical role for communities and volunteers in the provision of antiviral therapy. Involving community members and people living with the virus can make services accessible to the poor and the marginalized, and can also help to reduce stigma. That is to say, if people see somebody who is like them, somebody who is not like somebody from above, like the power relation, somebody telling them about antiviral therapy, they are more likely to comply and start accessing treatment than somebody from above. They say, maybe this one is saying this because he's a health worker, or maybe because this one is saying this because he's somebody of authority in the society. But if they can be told some experiences by somebody just like them, they are more likely to come forward and access treatment. And involvement of the community and volunteers is particularly critical in this era whereby we're experiencing a critical health worker crisis. They can also help to encourage involvement of community health workers. Has been critical in some other interventions, for example, in immunization procedures. And there is a need to develop their role in improving treatment access to strengthen the primary health care. Now looking at who is financing antiviral therapy in Malawi. Treatment activism has motivated increased funding for antiviral therapy. However, there is high donor dependency. This is necessary, but it raises sustainability challenges to say if the donors pull out, what will happen? And the high donor dependency is also associated with a slow disbursement of funds, where most of the times the funds, they come in chunks, regardless of what has been done on the ground. And current Global Fund money, which is funding antiviral therapy program, the program ends in 2008. We need a holistic view of financing. For example, as I alluded to in the previous slide, patients face costs even where antiviral therapy is provided free of charge at the point of delivery. And there's also a need to critically look at health expenditure as a percentage of total income. This has to be lower for the poor. And we need adequate and long-term funding for health assistance. What recommendations are we putting forward? There's a need for further decentralization of services with focus to rural areas, that is to primary health care level. As I said, most of the services are concentrated in the urban areas than in the rural areas. There's a need to strengthen links with other health programs, especially PMTCT through maternal health services, whereby the mothers are incorporated within the system and they know most of what can be done for them to also to access ART, for them not to infect their unborn babies. Monitoring impact of ART on socioeconomic status. This can help to reduce the high spending of the poor on health services. Monitoring of equity in ART programs and impact of ART on wider health systems. That is, equity monitoring has to be at all levels in the health system, and including simple equity and health system monitoring indicators in routine monitoring and evaluation system. That is, whenever monitoring and evaluation is done, there has to be some indicators on equity, for example, who is accessing services, which population, is it, for example, by gender and sex, so that we know if equity is there in access to the services. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Grace. I think we heard a very comprehensive presentation of your experience and that of REACH Trust in Malawi. Are there any imminent questions from the audience? The gentleman to my right, please introduce yourself and mention where you, which country you may be coming from.
Yes. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tendai Chibota from Zambia. I'm a patient. In fact, I was a patient. I'm a TB patient. Now I'm on ARDS. I just want to find out from the audience, I mean from the panel, how much on ARVs are you going to guarantee us? Because this money seems it's from coming from the donors. If the donor stops, who is going to guarantee our safety? It means we are going to die. That's my question. Then the other question is, we've got a lot of children now who are on ARDS. What other safety measures are you coming up in this in third world? Then the other question is...
Thank you, Tendai. Thank you. I think two questions from one person, perhaps, if you allow me, it's enough. Thank you.
Thanks.
Grace, would you like to comment on these rather tricky questions from our colleague from Zambia? Or shall we leave them for Stuart to answer, who comes from Zambia? Perhaps we'll hear how you tackle the same issues in Malawi.
Yeah, as I said in my presentation, a lot more children who are in need of antiretroviral therapy, they are left out. However, much is being done to incorporate the pediatric patient for them not to like die or because they are children. That's why at REACH Trust we like focus on equity. As I said, we can be happy with the figures saying 45,000 are on treatment, but who is on treatment? For example, is it men? Is it women? Are they children? What ages are they? And on high dependency on donors, I think I said that in a presentation that there is high dependency on donors. If the donors are pulled out, will the ART programs be there? Are we going to maintain the rolling out of antiretroviral therapy? I think, in short, that's how I can tackle his question.
Thank you. Let's entertain one more question from the audience and then we shall move on.
Thank you. My question would be, you started your presentation with can provision of ART be equitable when the whole health system is inequitable. What exactly is your conclusion from Malawi experience? Can this be done? Because I found there are two parts in your presentation. In one part, you mentioned that adding incentives, adding extra money, topping up the salaries, that creates inequitability within the system. Because if you have special focus on ART treatment. But when you are making those final recommendations for the programs or whatever, the improving ART access, they are only for ART access. So from your experience, you want to say that we can have an ART equitable access when the whole health system is inequitable, or it's not possible?
Okay. Thank you very much. When I was pointing out to say the salary top-ups for health workers is specific for some cadres and not others, it has to be pointed out that there are some other motivational factors or some other incentives which are not necessarily monetary in nature, which can motivate health workers and these other cadres who are also critical in the provision of antiretroviral therapy. For example, we have health surveillance assistants who are critical in the provision of counseling and testing. We cannot talk of antiretroviral therapy without talking of counseling and testing, because we know that CT is the entry point to ART. So when we talk of motivation factors, we don't have to like critically consider money, but there are some other things which can be also added to motivate our burned out health workers. And in terms of having an equitable health system to provide equitable services, the thing I'm trying to make is like, I think I say that the most critical challenge in the ART rollout is the lack of health workers, which means that there are some other populations in the, within the society which are failing to access treatment because we don't have the health workers to roll out treatment. I think I said in the, some of the barriers to access, saying long distances, for example, long waiting times, which means if somebody can work up until it's dark and he or she is coming from a very far away place, he or she is likely not to access treatment. So it's something that a lot has to be done on both, like having, for example, health workers who have the resources, who are motivated, and also they also have the treatment to roll out. So it's somehow tricky to have a health system which is inequitable to provide services which are equitable. I don't know if I've tackled your concerns.
Thank you.
Concerning top-ups for health workers, the top-ups are for all health workers within the public health system, and this is basically targeting clinicians, nurses, and medical doctors, and the other cadres are excluded. So I just wanted to clarify that because I think there was some misunderstandings.
Thank you very much for that additional information, and very many thanks to you, Grace, for your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our next speaker is going to be Stewart Reid, who comes from the Center for Infectious Disease Research based in Zambia, and he is currently the medical director for a PEFA program in Zambia. And he's going to present to us a very interesting session on human resource, which is a critical factor for the success of ART scale-up, especially in resource-limited settings. I'll take up this opportunity to invite you, Stewart.
Good afternoon. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to speak here this afternoon. I'd also like to acknowledge at this time my colleagues from the Zambian Ministry of Health and from the Lusaka branch of CDC. Some of the information that I've been listening to in the last half hour are very similar to the situation which we have in Zambia. As you all know, we are moving towards universal access for antiretroviral therapy by 2010, and that's not far away, that's less than 3 years away. And I'm going to start with my conclusion, which is that scarce human resources is the major barrier to scaling up ART and HIV care and treatment in sub-Saharan Africa. I'm going to talk a little bit about the task ahead of us, give you an idea of the magnitude of this task, and then talk a little more about the shortage of health workers in Zambia in particular, and then about some short-term solutions, but I emphasize these are short-term solutions and that we shouldn't become complacent. I will show you that it is possible to scale up antiretroviral therapy in a resource-limited setting, but we are at the limits of what we can do at the present time with the existing human resources. Zambia, as many of you may know, is a landlocked country in the southern cone of Africa and is one of the most heavily affected countries with the HIV epidemic and with the healthcare worker shortage. We have 11.5 million people, of which 16%, or about 1.1 million people, are HIV infected. In 2003, 90,000 people died of HIV-related causes, and just over a quarter of a million people are in need of ART today. Life expectancy is around 37 years. And this is Zambia right here. You can see we are surrounded by seven neighbors. Despite the challenges in the last slide, you can see that rapid scale-up has been proceeding fairly well in Zambia, with a lot of support from the Ministry of Health and political buy-in as well. 3 years ago, we had 3 centers and 3,000 people on treatment. Today, we have 110 centers with over 100,000 people enrolled and 70,000 on ART. There's a footnote at the bottom here which shows that despite putting on approximately 36,000 people on treatment each year, another 80,000 become eligible for ART. So the challenges for prevention are significant. This slide shows the estimated people needing ART, and I'm going to focus on sub-Saharan Africa. Right now, there are about 4.5 million people who are in need of ART today, and there are approximately 25%, or 1 million people as of June 2006, who are presently on ART, which gives us a treatment gap of 3.5 million people to achieve by 2010. And this is going to be a major challenge in the era of healthcare worker shortage. The map on the left shows you areas with critical healthcare shortage, and that is considered healthcare worker less than 2.8 per 1,000 population. You can see that North America and Europe have 18 to 24. Most of sub-Saharan Africa is in this dark color here, except for our neighbors in South Africa, Botswana, and Namibia. And unfortunately, many of our workers from other parts of Africa have migrated south to those countries. If you look at the map on the other side, you can see that the area's highest prevalence of HIV is in all very similar, in very similar countries. And so this dual burden of high HIV prevalence, low healthcare workers is the challenge we face. Let me focus for a minute on Zambia and show you that the, in general, the number of healthcare workers is less than one per 1,000 population, except in the urban areas, which, as Grace mentioned, is part of the issue of equity of distribution of healthcare workers. Our absolute deficit of doctors, nurses, and clinical officers is around 75% of those required, although compared to Malawi, we look like we are fairly well off at 7 per 100,000 of doctors. Zambia graduated 1,600 doctors from its medical school, and somewhere between 400 and 600 are remaining in the country. I'm going to talk just very briefly about why we have a shortage, and I understand there'll be sessions on Saturday which will describe this in more detail. But if you look at this graph here, you'll see that the countries with the arrows are those countries in the southern cone, and you can see that between 60 and 80% of the physicians that have been trained by those countries have migrated and left those countries, and most of those will not return. So migration is a huge concern for countries in Africa, both migration within Africa and migration overseas. Another area of major concern to us is premature death of our healthcare workers. In sub-Saharan Africa, somewhere between 18 to 40% of the healthcare workforce are HIV infected. The range here is rather broad because healthcare workers don't test. Testing is still stigmatized, and accessing treatment is even more difficult for them as well. You can see in the three categories of doctors, clinical officers, and nurses, the average age of death is around 37 years. This column here looks at the potential career that is being lost due to premature death, and somewhere between 46 to 56% of a healthcare worker's career is lost due to premature death. And the effect on the systems and the ability to care for patients in the public health system is affected by this. Another issue is that of absenteeism in the last year of life. As patients become more debilitated and sick, they become unable to work, and this is also affecting our ability to scale up ART care. Let's shift gears for a minute and talk about lessons that we've learned in Lusaka with our rapid scale-up, and I'll talk a little bit about how we've been able to scale up despite the enormous restrictions in terms of numbers of healthcare workers. Lusaka has 1.5 million people with a prevalence of 22%, which is higher than the national average. We have about 250,000 HIV-infected people, of which 56,000 are in immediate need of ART, and 28,000 become eligible each year. The ART scale up in Lusaka is very similar to that which I showed you in Zambia. Exponential growth in the numbers of patients who are enrolled and on ART. And to maintain this group of patients with chronic lifelong therapy is a major challenge. This has occurred in the last 2 years. I'd like to talk a little bit about the patients that we are enrolling in care, because I think the degree of illness and the advanced nature of the patient's illness also affects the amount of care they require. And you can see in this slide that most of our patients are stage 3 with CD4 counts of less than 150. So it tends to be a sick population, especially in the initial part of the scale-up, most of the patients were quite sick. The median age is 35, with 61%, very similar to Malawi, are female. 10% presented with a hemoglobin of less than 8, and 15% had TB in the last year. The mean CD4 count of all patients, and this was a group of 15,000 patients, was 143. 21% had CD4s less than 50, and 56% had CD4s between 50 and 200. So this is a sick group of patients. It raises many challenges in terms of care, in terms of drug toxicity, side effects, immune reconstitution, co-infection with TB. So it's a challenging group of patients to look after in any environment, in particular in Zambia. What I'd like to do is focus in on one of our clinics and give you an idea of the magnitude of the patient load that we are attempting to care for. At the present time, we have about 27,000 visits in Lusaka each month. We've had over 500,000 visits for care just in the ART clinics in the last 30 months. I'd like to talk about the Kanyama compound, which is one of the larger compounds. It's a bit of an outlier in that it's a very large clinic, but it's not completely unrepresentative of what we see in general. It's an urban compound or shanty town with a catchment population of 130,000 and an HIV prevalence of 22%, as I mentioned before. In this one clinic, we presently have about 7,000 patients enrolled in care and about 4,000 on ART. The daily workload includes follow-up visits, enrollment, pharmacy visits, a total of about 215 visits per day. What I'll talk about now in the next few slides is basically the problem, which is how do we provide quality care for large numbers of patients with significant healthcare shortage. And I'll talk about some short-term solutions that we've used to try to achieve this. The first one is improving clinic efficiency, expanding clinical roles or task shifting, involving the community, dealing with issues of overtime payment, and the last one has disappeared. There we go. Electronic database, which is another approach that we've used. Let's talk about clinic efficiencies. To care for this large number of patients, we had to work with the Ministry of Health to try to improve the efficiencies of the clinics to not only care for large numbers of patients, but to care for them in a chronic care form, which was not familiar in Zambia. We worked with and mentored the sisters in charge of each clinic in their managerial and organizational skills, and we helped them to organize the patient in terms of clinics, in terms of patient flow and triage. This required, in many cases, building extra space, providing equipment, and developing patient care forms that help the clinicians to work through complicated patients in a systematic way and also provided long-term follow-up for these patients. We worked on the issues of supply chain management, both as it relates to reagents and to drugs. Training was centered on issues of patient monitoring of chronic care, proper record keeping that would improve patient care, adherence counseling, and visit schedules. We engaged in the issue of task shifting, which is shifting task from specialized to less specialized healthcare workers, and then to the community and to the patient. So the direction of transfer of responsibilities is this way, and the direction of referral is this way. So the doctors transferred their responsibilities to the clinical officers, the clinical officers to the nurses for monitoring and continuation visits. The peer educators became involved in clerical work, adherence, health education, and the patients became involved as well. And this allowed us to transfer the responsibility for non-medical activities to the lower categories of healthcare worker or patient. Part of what we did was to recognize that nurses were the group of healthcare workers where we had the largest opportunity to increase skills and training. And we organized triage training skills, and we are at present organizing advanced nurse training to train nurses in critical thinking and problem solving, simple physical examination, and management of simple problems. The goal was to have nurses who could look after stable patients in the continuation phase. We're working with the Ministry of Health to expand these roles and to make this a part of the Ministry of Health policy. This is the continuum of care, and as you know, patients, when they are just enrolled into care, tend to be quite sick with multiple complications, drug toxicity, side effects, immune reconstitution, and breakthrough OIs. And this care is done primarily by the clinical officers and, where available, medical officers. Once we get through the initial phase of early treatment, we get into a routine continuation phase where the patients tend to be quite stable, and the major issue at this time is looking for evidence of treatment failure. And this is the phase where we tend to heavily involve nurse and the community. Once we've worked with the nurses, we also wanted to work and increase the capacity of the clinical officers in particular, because this is the group where we have, again, the second largest number of healthcare workers, and we felt that it was important to increase their skills, again, in chronic care, and we used a number of modalities to do that, including bedside teaching, management rounds, journal club, morbidity, mortality rounds. And then we did a lot of in-clinic mentoring with Zambian physicians and with expatriate nurse practitioners. We also developed a dedicated training center for clinical officers, which was a high-quality, low-volume clinic that was run by CARA Counseling. And you can see that we trained large numbers of staff, most of whom are nurses, clinical officers. The areas that the clinical officers became involved in were treatment initiation, management of immune reconstitution syndrome, treatment of opportunistic infections, the diagnosis of treatment failure, which has become more and more critical as time goes on, and the initiation of second-line treatment when appropriate. We also taught them management of TB co-infection and ART use in pregnancy. And the clinical officers became our major clinical players in the clinics. The role for the community, as Grace has also mentioned, and for peer educators, has become more and more important to reduce the work burden on medical staff and try to improve patient flow. We have, as I mentioned, large numbers of patients in these clinics, and to prevent long waiting times, we've employed the community and peer educators. They're involved in registration, demographic information, weighing, completion of forms, filing, and most importantly, adherence counseling. And you can see this is the group of staff. Again, in this group, mostly nurses, mostly peer educators, and community workers have been trained. To enable rapid scale-up in a setting with a very severe shortage of healthcare workers, we implemented an overtime model. And this was a way of trying to create health workers in an environment where they didn't exist. We presently are supporting 260 shifts a month at a cost of $25,000. And unfortunately, 80% of our clinics are now run on overtime shifts. Some of the disadvantages of this is that it is perceived as a project of an NGO. It creates a two-tiered system with those that receive overtime and those that don't, and that can create some unhappiness. We are concerned about staff burnout because, as Dr. San said, we are pushing our healthcare workers to the limit right now, and we need to look carefully at the issue of burnout. I don't believe that this is a sustainable way to keep the system going, but it is a stopgap measure to allow rapid scale up to occur. The staff like it because it gives them extra income. The last thing I wanted to talk about was our electronic database, and this is a way to use technology to improve efficiency and to reduce the amount of clerical tasks that healthcare workers do and allow them to concentrate on their medical tasks. The electronic database is used both for patient management but also to help us with quality control. It can generate Ministry of Health and donor reports. It will generate daily schedules for the nurses. We can do outcomes analysis and helps us to reinforce the treatment algorithms that we use. For quality of control, it will generate late lists, which then allow us to send out tracking nurses or tracking community workers to find the patients who are late. It allows us to monitor CD4s to see if patients are showing evidence of treatment failure, and it will also monitor critical lab values so that if patients have severe abnormalities of hemoglobin, for example, we can track those patients. We've developed an algorithm for treatment failure, and we are just implementing that now to try to identify patients who are either CD4 is not increasing appropriately, or the CD4 is dropping, or they may have changed the WHO stage while on therapy. Let's look back at Kanyama Clinic, which we talked about at the beginning, with its 7,000 patients and 4,000 on ART. This is the group who looks after that cohort of patients. You can see that the word nurse here figures very prominently. In fact, most of this clinic is run by nurses and peer educators and community. 76% of the workload is handled by non-clinicians or non-physician clinicians. We do have farm techs, lab techs, and some clinical officers who are providing, especially the clinical officers, most of the clinical care. But we've been able to have this clinic function with this group of staff, primarily nurses, community, and peers. Now, what's important is outcomes and how are we doing with this group of patients in this setting. This slide looks at the CD4 response of about 7,000 patients over a period of 2 years, sorry, 1 year. And you can see this line here represents, as I mentioned initially, the baseline CD4, the mean CD4 was 143, and we've seen an increase of 155 CD4 cells at 6 months and 175 at 12 months. The mean CD4 is around 300 at 6 months and around just over 300 at 12 months. There's a plateau phase here with a late increase. So this is a reasonable increase in CD4 rise, I think, in any environment, and we were pleased that we were able to see this outcome in our setting. Let's look at mortality on those starting antiretroviral therapy. If you look at stage 1 and stage 2, most of these patients, we have a less than 5% mortality. Things change significantly in stage 4. Mortality is anywhere from 10 to 15%, as high as 20%, depending on the CD4 count. Our highest mortality, of course, is in the group of the CD4 less than 50 and stage 4. And we are not absolutely sure the cause of the mortality here, and we are looking into that. We suspect it's related to undiagnosed TB, probably some drug toxicity, and immune reconstitution syndrome. Our overall mortality is 16 per 100 patients years. We have a high early mortality at less than 90 days of 26 per 100 patient years. But after 90 days, our mortality is 5 per 100 patient years, which is comparable to rates in other countries. Adherence is an important issue. We have difficulty measuring adherence, so we look at timeliness of drug collection. So do patients turn up on time to collect their drugs as a surrogate of adherence? And in 16,000 patients, the typical patient was 1 day late, 32% were not late at all, and 11% were 8 or more days late. Our data on treatment failure is still pending, but I think that this will be extremely important thing to monitor in terms of the success of the program. Let me summarize. Over the short term, we have found that it is possible to expand ART access with good clinical outcomes in a setting with extreme healthcare worker shortage by creating efficiencies in clinic flow, expanding workers' roles, providing overtime, and enlisting community and patients in care provision. However, we have to acknowledge that these are interim efforts and they should not distract us from working with ministries of health for long-term sustainable solutions, such as reducing migration, testing and treating healthcare workers for HIV and other diseases, and improving training and working conditions. In conclusion, there's no precedent in global health for the remarkable process that has been made to date providing ART in sub-Saharan Africa. However, the human resource crisis is the most critical factor to the success of further scale-up. If we do not make progress in resolving the healthcare worker shortage, we will limit the benefits, the healthcare or the public health benefits of expanding ART access, and our attempts to bring universal access to treatment will be thwarted. I'd like to acknowledge the healthcare workers of the Zambian Ministry of Health, as well as the Zambian Ministry of Health itself, the Lusaka District Health Management Team, and the CIDRS team. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stuart, for that very interesting presentation. Do we have any questions? Please remember to introduce yourself. Thank you.
Yes, Michael Kimmerling from U.S. Great talk, Stuart. Can you expound a little bit, since this is a TB meeting, a little bit about how you deal with screening for TB in the clinic and specifically the referral of patients from TB corner to the ART clinic so that the system of expediting care?
Yeah, I thank you, Michael. I left that slide out because of issues of time, but I'm glad you brought it up. About 70% of our TB patients are HIV infected, and of those, about 80% of them are eligible for ART. And we've tried to create an expedited flow of patients from TB clinics to the ART clinic. As soon as the patients are diagnosed with HIV, we do a CD4 count right away, and then they are immediately sent for enrollment in the HIV clinic. And we have special enrollment procedures for TB patients to get expedited enrollment into care. And so they are seen in the afternoon in a place where they are not going to pass on their TB infection, and they are quickly enrolled into care. TB clinics, I think, represent a very nice place to access large numbers of HIV-infected patients, almost all of whom are eligible for ART therapy. So the link between the TB clinic and the ART clinic, I think, is very important.
Thank you very much.
Who's next?
Go ahead. Ladies first.
Okay. Renee Ridson, Gates Foundation. The early mortality is something that is interesting and surprising or shocking, actually. And it's not surprising because a lot of people are seeing it. And the comment that it potentially is caused by undiagnosed TB. You may be in a situation, or I'd like to hear your thoughts about, firstly, making attempts to diagnose TB in these patients and what that might be. But secondly, something that's been talked about, which is by a couple of people, Kevin DeCock being one of them years ago, about starting people who are appearing to be failing up on TB therapy as empiric, with the realization that extrapulmonary disease is very difficult to diagnose at times.
Yes, thank you for that question. Clearly, TB is in our setting is very difficult to diagnose. We have a lot of atypical presentations of TB. Our only diagnostic tool is smear, and we have some limited chest X-ray. Our laboratories are overwhelmed with numbers, and I suspect that the amount of time that they are able to spend on reading smears is quite limited. So we do have a lot of difficulty in making diagnosis of TB in our setting, and we do treat empirically. For instance, if someone is enrolled in or started on ART and they are clearly not doing well, even though we are not able to make a firm diagnosis of TB, one of the next things that we will do is start TB treatment empirically. And that is the realities of working in an environment with little diagnostics and almost no healthcare workers. We don't have the data now, but we are starting liquid culture system in Lusaka in the next couple of months, and so we hope to have more data. We also are doing a study to look at the causes of early mortality in our cohort, working with the University Teaching Hospital. We'll take a group of patients who tend to be the stage 4 with CD4s less than 50, and we will intensively look at them to try to figure out what the co-infections are that may be causing death in this environment.
Over to you.
Okay. Dr. Gebe, Institute of Human Virology, Nigeria. Well done for a job under very crushing circumstances. My question is, again, these mortalities. You're seeing patients presenting at very late stages, just like we do, and I was worried in the sense that it's like your human resource burden is much more urgent than seemingly ours in Nigeria. And I was worried in the sense of diagnosis of TB, which is extrapulmonary, which, looking at the resources where that see 70% of your patients, is the strategy that you're using the best strategy to approach this, particularly in the case of diagnosis of extrapulmonary TB and empiric treatment for TB? And I'm presuming that the first line regimen you're using is a regimen that is very popular all across Africa, and with an 11% sort of failure to come for first follow-ups and missing drugs, with a regimen that is most likely high with the incidence of resistance, are we creating a mega problem?
I think this is something that we struggle with every day. The public health approach to ART scale-up has to be tempered with the quality of care that you can provide in a setting with limited resources, both diagnostic and human. We struggle. Your question is a very important one, because I think we struggle with numbers and quality, and we know that we're pushing our nurses and our clinical officers to provide care for a population which really does require specialist care, but it's not available. So I struggle with your concerns about the quality of care, about creating resistance, and about getting numbers of people on treatment. And I don't really have an answer for you, but I share your concerns.
Thank you very much. I'll request that we hold those two questions until after the last presenter has just shared his experience. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Lucy. It's my pleasure to introduce the fourth speaker for the symposium this afternoon. It's Dr. Francois Boyol, who is a consultant working with the International Union Against Tuberculosis and Lung Disease. He's based here in France. The topic of his presentation today is the state of health systems in low-income countries and access to ART. What is the way forward? Over to you, Francois.
Thank you very much, Rita. Well, treating a general topic as this one, especially at the end of such a symposium, carries the risk of getting lost, and I will try not to do so, at least not too much, in the following minutes. According to the World Bank definition, low-income countries are those countries with a gross national income lower than $875 per capita per year. But the next class of economies is called lower middle income. So for practical use in public health analysis, the limits of the low income category are not so simple. As by the definition, these low income countries make a group of 54 countries, among which there is already a tenfold national income difference. And only half of these countries are in the UNDP Low Human Development Group. 34 are considered fragile states, and two countries have the nuclear bomb. A common denominator among these countries is the difficulty to generate, nevertheless, accurate information at country level. and this makes analysis difficult, and we run the risk of drawing only broad conclusions that may not correspond to the reality of individual countries. The burden of HIV/AIDS also varies highly among those countries, and sub-Saharan Africa includes the highest number of countries with a generalized epidemic. The challenges posed by the access to ART may be quite different across countries. However, the past years, as it has already been mentioned, have seen a spectacular acceleration in access to antiretroviral therapy. The WHO estimates today that the number of people receiving treatment in low- and middle-income countries increases by 300,000 every 6 months. However, sketching out a way forward, as it was requested from me, to scale up ART in low-income countries' health systems faces the difficulty to draw lessons from experience, as published data on the effectiveness, on the cost-effectiveness of existing approaches are extremely scarce, and information on the cost associated with reaching these outcomes is almost always lacking. We will examine access to ART from the point of view of the challenges posed to medical techniques and technologies, organization of care, human resources, finances, and policy and institutional capacity. By doing so, we are not likely to provide definitive answers, as there may not be ready-made solutions, but rather try to review the questions and the issues to which a response adequate to the local context has to be given. Speaking of medical techniques and technologies, one characteristic of the AIDS field is the fast evolution of the medical techniques involved in diagnosis, treatment, and follow-up in a context where not applying the latest techniques may be criticized as under-medicine. Also, early ART programs were developed from models in industrialized countries. Scaling up efforts in poor countries with a high HIV burden have highlighted the benefits of using standardized approaches inspired from those used for tuberculosis. A clinical approach for initiating ART is demonstrating its value in Malawi for many patients. And while activist action has permitted to reduce the cost of first-line ARV regimen to about $130 per patient and per year, the standardization of first-line regimens and the use of fixed drugs combinations, words that sound familiar to this audience, have permitted to extend to many the benefits of effective treatment. Despite the simplification of procedures, a stark contrast remains between the techniques required in AIDS and those used in the management of other public health problems. ART scaling up may be an opportunity to strengthen medical system, but the risk of interference with sector development, of massive investment in developing technique with a narrow scope, is important. CD4 count and viral load measurement remain key to monitoring immune depletion and virological outcome of treatment. The tests require high-tech equipments, and today, access to the benefits related to these equipments is less constrained by the cost of the technology itself than by aspects more in relation with their environment. These include the availability and the quality of electrical power, the organization and availability of maintenance and of consumable logistics, or the adequacy of quality assurance systems. And are we going to see CD4 counters know the fate of out-of-order cardioscopes and computers that today litter the health facilities of many countries? Developing equitable access to HIV care requires that technologies become more appropriate to the needs of areas with lower prevalence. For instance, automated counters may not be adequate for health facilities that detect only a couple of patients per month, which is the case in, for instance, most West African countries. CD4 countings using magnetic beads, for instance, may provide a solution for such environments, provided that this technology is developed with that concern in mind and not as a competitor to automates. It may be implemented without major problem in most district-level laboratories or even in TB laboratories. This would require that the technical procedures be simplified, that kits of reagents be packaged appropriately for that level of implementation. These are specific health system development constraints, especially from the logistics part of it. As current viral load measurement cannot be decentralized, options may be either to develop semi-quantitative simple tests or to improve transport media to send samples to central points where assays can be performed. Commercial issues are equally important, as the number of HIV sufferers in high prevalence countries and the increasing availability of funds constitute a substantial market opportunity for the medical technology and pharmaceutical industries. After the spectacular results obtained on drug prices, new challenges for activist networks may perhaps be to make available more appropriate and cheaper laboratory technologies, but also to help countries to be less vulnerable to commercial pressures. Measuring the outcome of ART, as the previous speaker already mentioned, poses the problem of compiling huge amounts of survival data for several years. If information on ART coverage is available, few countries today have reported on outcomes of their ART programs. Methods of cohort follow-up developed on the same principle as for TB or leprosy have demonstrated their usefulness, but the volume of information is such that only few indicators can be monitored. Computerized systems face the same technological constraints as medical diagnosis, and their value at program scale may be debatable. As only few indicators are used to evaluate programs, efforts are still required to simplify information systems while keeping them robust enough for field conditions. Speaking of organization of health services, the development of primary care services in many low-income countries, which was the cornerstone of many health policies, has seldom been accompanied with parallel development of secondary and tertiary care. Referral services at district level remains limited to basic clinical or surgical procedures, and the availability of medical or laboratory diagnosis, critical care, or paramedical services such as psychological support remains low. Inadequate resources and support result in competition between levels of care for delivering primary care to patients. Health systems in low-income countries have not been designed to deliver chronic care, and the debate on the verticality of programs such as TB or leprosy or now even ART often reflects the lack of space given to chronic disease in the development of health systems. A specificity of effective ART programs is the cumulative caseload. Early programs were concentrated in specialized facilities, both in the public and sometimes non-government sectors. More recently, Malawi has showed that good results can be achieved at large scale without verticalization of ART services. Decentralization to district hospitals has been an important progress, but for poor people in some countries, the indirect costs of collecting treatment from a district hospital may still generate similar access and regularity problems as for TB treatment. Decentralizing ART beyond district hospitals will require involving paramedical staff, and some countries already explore the feasibility of involving the network of TB clinics. The interest of mobilizing communities through community-based ART programs or through involving community health workers should also be assessed, as it has demonstrated its usefulness for other chronic care. Besides clinical services, few countries have actually developed strong logistic support services as part of the general health systems. AIDS-related supplies have a relatively short shelf life in comparison with those used in TB. Effective logistic systems is therefore key and critical not only to uninterrupted supply, but also to controlling the costs by limiting batch expiry. In the context of programs, standardized procedures may contribute to limit the number of items to procure and deliver and improve the effectiveness of logistics. In this respect, the experience of tuberculosis may also be useful. When technologies are implemented, particular attention should be paid to consumable logistics, maintenance, and quality assurance. The experience of Malawi also suggests that government health services are capable of delivering similar level of quality ART as NGOs, and that a strong national ART program can be established on the backbone of a national health system. One may also wonder if there is room for the private sector in delivery and support to ART programs, and if governments are prepared to let private actors play a role. The experience of Cameroon in this regard would be extremely informative, as networks of private practitioners have developed their own ART program. I will try not to expand much on human resources, as the essential has already been said. But the constraints, of course, on the health workforce are the single greatest challenge to improving service delivery in many low-income countries today. The size of the workforce is related to training enrollment and the rate of attrition, which is itself affected by migration and AIDS. The weak link also between health system needs and the training of human resources is often responsible for an imbalance between medical and paramedical professions and confusion about their role. It is also responsible for an imbalance between care and support profession. Odd deployment of staff between urban and rural areas, less equitable access to health programs, low salaries and poor work environment result in low and inadequate performance of health staff, and in many places, providing only meaningful wages to staff may be enough to obtain good and sometimes outstanding performance. Skill development of the different staff categories is often fragmented between different programs, also without clear comprehensive vision. Expansion of ART is directly affected by these constraints and will benefit from sound human resources policy. But among countries with a generalized AIDS epidemic, the needs may vary dramatically. While a medium burden center would, for instance, start ART in 50 new patients per month in Malawi, a high burden center would start ART in less than 20 new patients per month in Benin. An analysis of the performance of low-income countries in developing access in view of their medical density shows on this graph that despite a low number of doctors per capita, some countries have been able to achieve substantial coverage. Among the better performers are also countries with high level of HIV epidemic. Such a finding is disturbing considering the human resource crisis. And one may wonder what happened. Of course, Stuart has already provided some information, some responses to those questions. But are those responses the same across countries? What happened? Who is doing the job, and what is the quality of that job in those countries which have achieved substantial coverage with low medical density per population? There is no ready answer to those questions. And it's then difficult to sketch out a way forward from such data without more information on the experience. The tasks associated with ART package delivery should be analyzed from the point of view of the skills and the time necessary for adequate performance at the different levels of decentralization and patient load. Like Zambia, some health systems have already developed know-how in managing chronic communicable stigmatized diseases, and useful lessons may be drawn from other programs. Expanding ART may be an opportunity to strengthen health systems by further developing skills for chronic care and linking it with prevention and more generally primary health care. The critical role of logistics, maintenance and management professions in the success of ART programs should also challenge health system developers on how to make available and further develop the necessary skills. In many low-income countries, health financing rests to a large extent on user payments, and hopes that cost sharing would permit to increase health financing and narrow financing gaps have not materialized. So far, community insurance initiatives have not demonstrated their capacity to take over a substantial share of health financing, and certainly not the cost of ART. Financing the essential components of free programs such as vaccination or TB reached adequate levels in the past few years only because of international support. In many countries, the volume of aid largely exceeds national public investment. Recent advocacy for generalizing the gratuity of care will no doubt improve access for the poor, but may further increase tensions by increasing countries' dependence on international resources. Empirical evidence confirms that ART should be provided free to the patients. Countries like Senegal have demonstrated that the costs of recovering patients' contributions to their treatment are higher than what patients can themselves contribute. Substantial financing is now available from the Global Fund, the World Bank, and a couple of bilateral donors and debt relief programs. But despite OECD efforts to harmonize aid, streamlining donor resources at national level remains a great challenge. Now the issue is less to increase the volume of aid than to streamline the existing resources and increase the capacity of health systems not only to absorb financing, but also to efficiently transform financing into benefits for the patients. As intense as advocacy has mobilized important financing on ART, it becomes necessary to look carefully at what this financing pays for. While the effectiveness of ART programs is beginning to be documented, there is still limited information available on the cost of the different approaches and on the systemic impact of financing some costs of ART programs that may not be financed for other health priorities. The harmonization of aid not only concerns financial flows, but also the goods purchased with aid money, as the aid of some donors remain tied. Tied aid is an obstacle to the constitution of homogeneous fleets of equipment that would facilitate consumable logistics and maintenance, and untying aid used to purchase inputs should be strongly promoted among donors. While clinicians still debate on the most appropriate ARV drugs and the pertinence of standardizing second-line treatment, the public health debate focuses on whether priority should be given to providing wide access to first-line treatment, while second-line remain limited to few centers. As resources are not limitless, principles of equitable health gain, limitation of systemic distortion may help better set priorities. Moreover, this debate remains limited to health and aid circles, which may not have the adequate legitimacy for making such decisions. How can the debate better involve the beneficiaries, and who should take responsibility for that? There is consensus on limited stewardship capacity of many health systems, but the causes for this low capacity may vary largely between countries. Causes may include political culture, limited career development prospects, competition from other sectors, tensions on resources, etc. We have already examined the importance of a balanced development of care and support systems. Weak institutional capacity also hinders the ability of systems to adequately coordinate and streamline increasingly complex aid fluxes. Delegation of aid to a cascade of competing agencies may not only hinder sound planning, but also limit the volume available for beneficiaries and increase the personnel in charge of grant management. In this respect, the impact of aid's business, to quote a Lancet editorial of last August, may also need to be evaluated. Limited institutional capacities in health ministries may also force programs to broker their own resources and compete for external funding. Projects may contribute to turn programs into semi-autonomous agencies behaving more like competitors than like partners within a same organization, as their institutional hierarchies cannot play their regulatory role. Accountability for public resources is obviously necessary. Rapidly developing mechanisms to account for the millions of dollars coming from sources with various accounting policies is per se a considerable institutional challenge for organizations or ministries with regular budgets within the thousands of dollars. The capacity of multiple and poorly coordinated mechanisms of aid delivery seeking quick, visible results to further undermine already fragile health systems should not be underestimated. In conclusion, the commitment and tenacity of dedicated networks of people has permitted spectacular progress in access to ART and allowed it to become a reality in an increasing number of low-income environments. It's now time to draw lessons from country experiences and analyze the cost-effectiveness and systemic impact of the different approaches. this moment may be the right one before more resources are mobilized to sustain existing experiences and further develop them. Resisting the verticalization of ART programs offers an opportunity to strengthen medical and support systems, which should not be missed as it may permit to develop care of chronic diseases and better address this increasing health challenge. But to find possible way forward, we direly need that those poor countries involved in expanding access to ART share their experience and publish their data. I would like to acknowledge my colleagues of the Union, Rita Dlodlo, Paula Fujiwara, and Odile Ferroussier, who have helped me in preparing this paper. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Francois, for your thought-provoking presentation. Are there any questions from the audience? I see a hand. Would you like to come forward to the microphone? Okay. Perhaps I misinterpreted the raise of the hand. May I then ask perhaps the three other speakers to join us here behind the table, including you, Francois, if you so wish, for the final questions or comments from the audience. I know that Lucy was required due to the limitations of time to cut off a couple of questions earlier on. I think we are now ready to take them, and you are free to address any of the speakers now. Thank you. Over to you.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Jan Voskens from KNCV Tuberculosis Foundation. Very interesting presentations, all of them. It seems that most of the solutions for the overstretched health services that are dealing with HIV patients are directed at the public health services. And also looking at the data that presented, that were presented by Stewart, I believe, that about 11% of the patients were late on their visit. I'm getting quite worried that even when numbers are increasing, the problem will get bigger. My question is there any experience of involving other providers, be it other public health programs like Mother and Child Health, or private providers or informal providers in the provision of the ART? It means that VCT could still be centralized, but the provision of treatment delegated to other providers. Thank you.
Thank you. Would you like to address this, Stuart? And if any other speaker has thoughts in this regard, please feel free to contribute them. Thank you.
In Zambia, recently, the Ministry of Health made antiretroviral drugs free to the private sector. And I know that there's a lot of experience in the private sector in prescribing antiretroviral drugs. I think that this initiative by the Ministry of Health is a very positive one, because I think that the patients who go to the private sector may have less than perfect adherence because of problems and pain. And so I think that this will help to improve adherence. I think we all have concerns about adherence to care, as you mentioned, and we're all learning as we build experience, I think we're learning better ways to get patients to adhere to care. Of course, we're also concerned about the issue of treatment fatigue. We're still in the early phase of ART scale-up in Africa, and the issue of treatment fatigue is also a concern. But I think the private sector has got a large role to play, and governments should probably support them.
Ian would like to add his views in this regard.
So in our program, in the Right to Care program funded by PEPFAR, we in fact have engaged the private sector general practitioners in providing treatment on a capitation fee model basis. In other words, we pay for everything for the patient, including consultation fees to the general practitioner, and have successfully recruited 53 doctors and I think over approximately 1,200 patients now onto the program. It has been successful. We've just done an economic evaluation of the program, and in fact, it's it costs about double what the cost is of our Thembelethu site. So for every successfully treated patient, successful defined as viral load undetectable, alive, immune reconstitution at 1 year, the cost of Thembelethu is about $1,100 per annum. All costs included, opportunistic infections, everything. Whereas the cost in the private sector is about $2,000. Cost driven mainly by the types of patients that they're putting on and the ability to actually maintain follow-up. The other issue, the SIPRA study in South Africa, Safeguard the Household, is targeting looking at nurse practitioners providing treatment care on ongoing monitoring. That study will become available early next year. It's nurses randomized versus doctors. And the last point I wanted to make, I've forgotten. Sorry, having a mature moment, sorry.
Thank you. Can I pose a thought to the speakers? What's the role of the community, members of community, or perhaps treatment supporters in this regard? I hear whispers here from the last speaker, but I think I must first hear from the left-hand side and then possibly from you. Any comments, any experiences, thoughts? Grace, you look like you wish to say something. Does it crack the microphone nearest to you, please?
My question is it on the role of the community or the role of the private providers?
I was trying to push us to think in terms of community members or family members, neighbors or friends, treatment buddies, because I think in a number of our settings in sub-Saharan African countries, we do have a presence of private sector in bigger urban centres, but it's not necessarily so in rural areas where 70% of the population may live.
Okay. I'll explain from experience, that is from Malawi. In Malawi, maybe in the African setting, you know that social support, the issue of extended families is like sort of tight, though with the influence of HIV/AIDS is sort of like loosening up. However, it's important also to include or recognize the importance of community members. For example, they can help in adherence issues, for example, reminding the patient to take treatment, or even escorting the patient to get treatment. So we cannot remove or completely ignore the role of the community members or relatives in the provision of antiretroviral therapy. It's more especially in the least developed countries. Thank you.
Any other contributions on the community's role?
I think I said something as a patient on behalf of Zambia, because I'm from a district in the Copper Belt province, Masaiti district in the Copper Belt province. I'm a patient of myself, and I'm a TB treatment support. We've got a problem in our rural sector. We do need to help the health providers, but the access, when you want to help you want to do the dots to the patients, we are finding difficult because there are some other procedures which are required for poor people to organize themselves, to register, to open an account for them to be funded so that they can do their work properly. Especially when somebody is doing a volunteer work, he's not paid anything. But to assist that patient, maybe that patient cannot take drugs on an empty stomach, which is very difficult. So those are the problems which we are facing in the community, especially in the rural sector in Zambia.
Thank you very much for your contribution, and I think that you echo some of the sentiments that also Grace very eloquently touched on regarding the indirect costs, even in situations where, for example, TB treatment and now antiretroviral treatment is or would be free of charge. Thank you. I believe that my co-chair Lucy has a question. I think we have to hear what she has in her mind.
Thank you, Rita. The first question is basically to Ian, and now that he's mentioned that he's working in a PEFA-funded project, what are you doing considering that when you look at the African scenario, there are many countries that are actually faced with the challenge of food insecurity? How are you merging in the issue of ART in the low-income areas with trying to come up with strategies that would be able to address the issue about food insecurity? And the other question is to Stuart. I'm rather concerned as a nutritionist who's practicing in a HIV program. Why is it that, I don't know whether this was an oversight, that you don't have nutritionists in Zambia?
Let Ian go first.
And big questions. So the PEPFAR program per se does not fund any food security. However, the national program in South Africa does require for each of the treatment sites, each of the CCMT sites, to in fact integrate nutrition education as part of the site plans for rollout of ARVs. There are a number of NGOs that support the ARV treatment sites, in particular in our setting, CARE, who provide particular nutrition support to the extremely malnourished patients identified within the clinic. As part of the services of the clinic, and South Africa has a very good social network, and disability grants can be applied for periods of time while patients are extremely ill, and childcare grants, and one of our strategies for food security is to apply for such grants.
I think Lucy quickly picked out one of the weaknesses of our system is that we do not have nutritionists in Zambia. We are working with the World Food Program to provide nutritional supplementation to patients. We've also noticed that patients who present with a low BMI, less than 16, it's a strong predictor for mortality. So there's no question that nutritional supplementation is something that we need to work more on. We are looking at the issue of refeeding syndrome to see whether part of the early mortality that we may be seeing may be related to some electrolyte abnormalities, that including specifically phosphorus abnormalities that may develop in the early stages of immune reconstitution syndrome. But yes, nutritionists are a shortage in Zambia.
Thank you very much for these responses and questions. I wonder if there are any other burning issues from the audience. I know that we have practically come to the end of our time, but considering that we had a late start due to the very popular and somewhat longer than budgeted preceding session, Lucy and I thought of allowing a few more minutes for this session. I think we have exhausted our thoughts on this very controversial and difficult issue, something that will require our thinking cabs, our intelligence also in the future. Lucy, I call upon you to give some closing remarks. Thank you.
Thanks, Rita, for that. I just want to sum up by saying that we actually need to address the issue of human resource shortages, more so in an era whereby we are seeing that in majority of the ART sites, the staff are actually experiencing lots of burnouts, and this in the long run is going to lead to uncompromised care. So this is an issue that as professionals we should actually take up and back up our support so that much more resources are actually coming up for health systems, strengthening and also the human resource supports. And on that note, I think I'm going to wish you all a lovely evening. If you haven't been to the Eiffel Tower, make sure you go up there because it's really fun.
Thank you.